You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, March 19th at 6 p.m. in person at the station at 118 South Bedford Street. The public is welcome to attend. This meeting is also available virtually via Zoom. For information on how to attend this meeting virtually, please email president@wortfm.org.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, March 16th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Before we begin, we want to thank everyone who has donated to Worldview and to WORT during our recent fundraising drive. Your support for community radio has made us feel wanted and needed, and has reinforced WORT volunteers' commitment to bring you the best news, information, and entertainment we can find. As you may have heard, we met and surpassed fundraising goals, but there were funds left in that matching grant provided by a loyal and outstanding donor for new donors and lapsed donors. That donor has now agreed to use those leftover funds to match donations from anyone who wants to give up until midnight tonight. So if you want to donate, increase your donation, or become a monthly donor, all those donations will be doubled. And the WORT thank you gifts are available until that deadline. To take advantage of the opportunity, you need to go online because there are no phone answers here today. So you need to go to WORTFM.org and click on the orange banner across the top of the page and follow the directions there. Later in the program, we will have WORT staffer Carlos Davalos in the studio with Worldview's Gil Halstead and Amitabh Pal to discuss Mexico, Mexican and U.S. relations, politics, economics, and culture at about the half hour. But first, we have the news.
Talks to extend the Gaza ceasefire have failed as the U.S. accused Hamas of making, quote, entirely impractical, unquote, demands at the latest round of meetings in Qatar. The first phase of the temporary truce ended on March 1st. The U.S. proposed an extension until mid-April, including more exchanges of hostages, but delaying the negotiation of a permanent end to the war. The disagreement is over key aspects of the deal set out by U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff at the indirect talks with Hamas. Yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu showed willingness to continue the negotiations if the U.S. proposals include the release of 11 living Israeli hostages and the bodies of half of the deceased hostages. The U.S. accuses Hamas of refusing to budge, accusing the group of manipulation and psychological warfare. Hamas has affirmed its commitment to the existing agreement, demands that Israel abide by all its provisions, and calls on mediators to immediately begin negotiations for the second phase, which includes an Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and a complete cessation of hostilities.
Thousands of Syrians waving the new Syrian flag and holding banners reading, "The revolution has triumphed," took to the streets and public squares in several Syrian cities yesterday to commemorate the 14th anniversary of the outbreak of protests against the now-ousted Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian General Security closed the entrances to the central square in Damascus and distributed roses to the crowd while the radio blared revolutionary and Islamic songs. Helicopters dropped leaflets with the statement, There is no room for hatred between us because Syria needs pure hearts and united hands. Despite the relief of having deposed Assad, the new Syrian authorities face numerous challenges related to managing the transitional period. A constitutional declaration was approved last week, but opponents claim that the constitution gives the new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, absolute powers in the administration of the transitional period. The issue of minority groups and their rights have yet to be addressed, and the economy is in shambles with the country still under sanctions. But Syrians enjoyed a moment of relief and hope with flowers, music, and flag waving.
Ebola is a deadly viral disease spread through direct contact with bodily fluids that causes severe bleeding and organ failure. The 2013 to 2016 West African epidemic of Ebola caused 28,600 cases with 11,325 deaths, while the 2018 to 2020 Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Uganda resulted in 3,481 cases and 2,299 deaths. A vaccine that improves outcomes, meaning fewer deaths, was approved in 2019, but requires costly cold storage and is difficult to administer at the sites of Ebola outbreaks. A study published in the Science Advances magazine last week reported on tests of the antiviral obeldesivir, the oral form of the pill of intravenous remdesivir, originally developed for COVID-19. The antiviral was tested on infected rhesus and cynomolgus macaques, protected 80% of the cynomolgus macaques and 100% of the rhesus macaques, which are biologically closer to humans. The drug cleared the virus from the treated monkey's blood and also triggered an immune response, helping them develop antibodies while avoiding organ damage. Testing will continue if funding from the U.S. National of Institutes of Health does.
An electrical substation in Cuba failed on Friday, leaving the majority of the country's 10 million citizens without power. The blackout started at 8:15 Friday evening, and most of those affected were still without power throughout Saturday. The Cuban Electricity Union released a statement that their strategy is to restore microsystems within the grid that will eventually connect to gradually deliver power to the entire country, first focusing on critical services, such as hospitals. Cuba's outdated electrical grid was responsible for a string of similar blackouts in 2024, and residents commonly experience power cuts during peak hours as electricity generation struggles to meet demand. In 2021, 22, and 24, blackouts and power cuts prompted large anti-government demonstrations. Many Cuban citizens have expressed concern that, in addition to impacting critical services, an extended blackout could also lead to food spoilage and water shortages, as most are reliant on electrical appliances to store and cook food and to pump water.
A judge in Guatemala issued an order on Monday to return Jose Zamora to jail in a case stemming from money laundering charges brought against the journalist in 2022. Zamora was charged with money laundering in 2023, amounting to a total of $38,000, and was sentenced to 6 years in prison. However, the decision was appealed and later overturned due to errors in the judicial process. An order issued in October of 2024 allowed Zamora to return to his home after more than 2 years in jail to remain on house arrest during the appeals process. Monday's decision, issued by Judge Eric Garcia, labeled Zamora as, quote, a flight risk, and ordered his return to jail. Zamora has insisted that both the criminal charges and Monday's decision were politically motivated revenge for his open criticism of former President Alejandro Giammattei. Following the decision, Zamora said, quote, here I am. I've demonstrated that I come to hearings and I go to put my fingerprints in the prosecutor's office, unquote. Prior to the hearing, on Monday, current President Bernardo Olivero, Giammattei's successor, said, quote, it is an absolutely spurious case and reveals the worst of the crisis in our judicial system and shows the strategies of criminalizing that the Attorney General's office is using against those fighting corruption, unquote.
The United Nations announced a funding shortfall last week, which will impact food assistance programs around the world. In Myanmar, it will result in more than 1 million people being cut off from a vital food source. A statement by the World Food Program, or WFP, said that most food assistance currently distributed in Myanmar will end in April. Also impacted are the Rohingya, a Muslim minority, who have long been persecuted in Buddhist-majority Myanmar. There are almost 100,000 internally displaced Rohingya and over 700,000 in refugee camps in Bangladesh that have been open since 2017. Neighboring Thailand also hosts more than 100,000 refugees that will be impacted, according to activists and Thai officials. Myanmar has seen serious armed conflict between the government and local militias since the army ousted the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi in February 2021. The WFP said 15.2 million people, nearly one-third of the total population, are unable to meet their minimum daily food needs, and over 2 million face emergency levels of hunger. Asked whether the Myanmar funding cuts were a result of recent U.S. moves to stop foreign aid, a spokesperson at the UN wasn't clearly able to draw a connection, but said that all UN agencies are actively engaging with U.S. authorities, quote, to explain the immediate damage that's been done.
In the Balochistan region of Pakistan, militants from the Baloch Liberation Army, or BLA, derailed the train by setting off explosives in a remote area. They then took more than 100 passengers hostage. The train was carrying mostly Pakistani police and military personnel, which the BLA threatened to execute if their demands for the release of Baloch political prisoners were not met. After a day-long standoff with the militants, Pakistani security forces stormed the train and killed 33 BLA members. Others are believed to have escaped and are being pursued. 21 civilians and 4 security personnel were killed in the gun battle. Balochistan is Pakistan's largest and least populated province, with a wealth of natural oil and mineral resources. The ethnic Baloch people believe that the government of Pakistan discriminates against them, but the central government denies this. The BLA is a designated terrorist organization by most nations of the world, including the U.S.
In a highly unusual move, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said South Africa's ambassador to Washington, Abraham Rasool, is no longer welcome in the United States and expelled him from the country. The South African presidency called the move to expel Rasool a regrettable one and urged all stakeholders to maintain diplomatic decorum. Rasool, a Muslim, has been a critic of Israel, called its treatment of Palestinians in Gaza a genocide, and accused it of apartheid. He was also a prominent advocate for South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Trump froze U.S. aid to South Africa in February because he says it has a new law that allows the government to expropriate private land and that it targets minority white farmers. South Africa denies its new law is tied to race and says Trump's claims are full of misinformation and distortions spread by white nationalists, particularly by South African-born billionaire Elon Musk.
And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Gil with our first longer story.
Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was arrested at Manila's Nino Aquino International Airport last Tuesday after returning from Hong Kong, where he had been campaigning to return to political office. The arrest was based on a warrant from the International Criminal Court of Justice, or ICC, accusing him of crimes against humanity related to his administration's war on drugs from 2016 to 2022. The warrant said that prosecutors built their case using evidence including witness testimony, government documents, video footage, and speeches of Duterte himself. The former president's anti-drug campaign was notorious for its widespread extrajudicial killings. Human rights organizations estimate that up to 30,000 deaths can be attributed to the program, and the ICC began its investigation in 2018. Duterte was transferred to the Villamor Air Base in the Philippines before being flown under heavy guard to The Hague, Netherlands, to stand trial. Prosecutors accused Duterte of being an indirect co-perpetrator in multiple murders for allegedly overseeing killings beginning in November of 2011, when he was the mayor of the city of Davao, and continuing on through his time as president of the Philippines. According to prosecution documents, Duterte issued orders to police and other agents to, quote, kill criminals, including drug dealers, and provided them with the necessary weapons and resources and promised to shield them from prosecution. The arrests elicited mixed reactions within the Philippines. Supporters of Duterte viewed the action as a political move, leading to protests in some regions. Conversely, victims' families and human rights advocates hailed the arrest as a significant step toward justice, expressing hope for accountability regarding the drugs the drug war's atrocities. Duterte's legal defense team has already said that the current Philippine government should not have allowed the ICC to take custody of the former leader because the Philippines is no longer a party to the International Criminal Court. Judges who approved Duterte's arrest warrant said that the court has jurisdiction because the crimes alleged in the warrant were committed before Duterte withdrew the Philippines from the court in 2019.
China's highest legislative body, the National People's Congress, completed its annual meeting on Tuesday after 10 days in Beijing. With nearly 3,000 members, it is the largest legislative body in the world. Nominations and election to the Congress are controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. With other formal meetings that are held concurrently, it is the busiest week of the year for Chinese politicians. A main theme of this year's meeting was the economy. China opened the Congress with Premier Li Qiang presenting an ambitious 5% growth target for 2025, which matches last year's rate. To achieve this, the government announced a number of initiatives, including rebates to Chinese consumers on cars and household appliances worth over $41 billion. Housing will receive increased government support, and revitalizing private businesses will be a priority. Some of the spending for the growth programs would be supported by increased government borrowing. Some observers are skeptical that the growth target can be reached, but China has a history of adding stimulus programs later in the year. Military spending in China will be increased by 7.2% in 2025, the fourth straight year with at least 7% growth. China continues to aggressively assert its dominance of the South China Sea and reiterated its stance on reunification with Taiwan. On the issue of Uyghur forced labor, Party Secretary for the Xinjiang region, Ma Xinggui, acknowledged for the first time that U.S. sanctions passed in 2021 are having a serious impact on the area's economy. The U.S. blacklisted 144 companies and excluded them from trade under the law. Secretary Xinggui continued to deny the forced labor accusations. Congress also addressed the tariff war with the U.S. After two rounds of tariff increases by the United States in January, Commerce Minister Wang Wentao said, quote, "If the American side goes further down this wrong path, we will fight to the end," unquote.
Demonstrations in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, turned violent on Wednesday as retirees and soccer fans joined forces to demand increased pensions for elderly citizens. Many elderly Argentinians report that due to President Javier Milei's libertarian policies, government pensions no longer cover the cost of living or allow retirees to maintain a quality of life. Prior to a scheduled 5 p.m. protest on Wednesday, police deployed water hoses and shotguns outside the Congress. Clashes between protesters and police began when a group of Boca Juniors soccer fans arrived at the demonstration, waving flags and chanting in solidarity with the retirees. Police blocked their advance towards Congress and began spraying elderly protesters at the back of the march with high-pressure water cannons. Violence escalated as protesters began throwing rocks while police used water cannons and rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. During the protest, more than 100 people were arrested and dozens injured. Secretary of Security Patricia Bullrich filed a criminal complaint following the arrests, accusing the detainees of sedition, attacking the constitutional order, and illicit association. Bullrich has also warned she may bring charges of prevarication and violation of the duties of a public official against Judge Karina Andrade, who ordered the release of nearly 100 of those who were detained. Among the injured was Pablo Grillo, a photographer who was shot in the face with a rubber bullet. He suffered a fractured skull and remains in the hospital. This event, among others in recent years, has raised concerns for the safety of journalists in Argentina. Following the events on Wednesday, journalist Luciana Lavilla stated, quote, "Nothing mattered to the government, nor to those who were repressing. This, of course, provoked a response from the press union in solidarity with Pablo, but also to denounce that every day it becomes more difficult to fulfill the journalistic task," unquote.
A London judge heard the final arguments on Thursday for a lawsuit alleging that the global mining giant, the BHP Group, is liable for one of the worst environmental disasters in Brazil's history. In 2015, the Mariana Dam in southeastern Brazil collapsed, spilling over 43 million cubic meters of mine waste into the Doce River. The disaster led to the death of 19 people, displaced hundreds, killed over 14 tons of freshwater fish, and damaged 410 miles of the Doce River. The lawsuit, filed on behalf of over 600,000 Brazilians and 46 municipal governments, is suing BHP Group for over $43 billion. Pamela Fernandez, a 31-year-old woman impacted by the disaster, traveled to London for the court proceedings. Her 5-year-old daughter was killed by the flood when the dam collapsed. Outside the courthouse on Thursday, she said, quote, "The memories of Manu are always with me. It is very difficult. I want justice so that I can be at peace, so that my daughter can be at peace," unquote. The prosecutors who brought the lawsuit argue that BHP Group owns 50% of Samarco, the company operating the mine at the time of the disaster, and is therefore liable for the damages. In his closing argument, attorney Alan Chu Choi stated, quote, "As a result of its heavy involvement in Samarco's operations, BHP had many opportunities to avert disaster, but failed to do so, and instead kept allowing and encouraging the dam to be raised by constantly pushing for ever greater production by Samarco," unquote. The defense argued that the BHP Group did not own or operate the dam, and that the deadline for filing the lawsuit was missed. The defense also argued that the lawsuit was a duplication of legal proceedings in Brazil. High Court Justice Finolo Farrell is expected to release her ruling in the coming days.
For the first time since the ceasefire between the Israeli occupation regime and Hamas, the Israeli army today acknowledged the assassination of 6 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, including a freed prisoner. The Israeli army's previous killings since the pause in fighting in the Gaza Strip targeted Palestinians who approached Israeli forces without identifying the Palestinian targets. In the last round of killings, Israel released the names of the 6 targeted and killed, as it did during the genocide when assassinating leaders or activists in Palestinian armed factions. Israeli military spokesman for the Arabic media, Achive Adrei, said in a statement that his forces attacked a, quote, "terrorist cell" in the Beit Lahia area in the northern Gaza Strip on Saturday, including a terrorist who crossed the border during the horrific October 7, 2023 massacre, unquote. He was referring to Mustafa Mohammed Shaban Hamad, who was killed in the airstrike. The spokesman claimed that the 6 Palestinians were operating a drone aimed at promoting terrorist plots against Israeli military forces operating in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli statement said that among the assassinated were an engineer for Hamas, a photographer for Hamas, a member of Hamas who was wearing a media uniform, an Islamic Jihad activist and freed prisoner, Suhaib Basim Khalid al-Najjar, who was released in the recent deal, as well as Muhammad Allah Subi al-Ghafir, a Hamas member, according to the statement. On October 7, 2023, Hamas fighters attacked military bases and settlements near Gaza, killing and capturing Israelis in response to, as Hamas said, quote, daily crimes of the Israeli occupation against the Palestinian people and their holy sites, especially the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Israeli illegally occupied Palestinian territories, unquote. With American support, Israel perpetrated a genocide in Gaza between October 7, 2023 and January 19, 2025, leaving more than 160,000 Palestinians dead and wounded, most of them children and women, and more than 14,000 still missing.
Yemen's Houthi-affiliated media reported that ongoing U.S. strikes on Yemen have killed and wounded dozens and destroyed a power generation station. The group vowed to respond while U.S. officials said the attacks could continue for weeks to curb the Houthi threat to maritime navigation in the region. Airstrikes and missile launches from U.S. warships in the Red Sea began Saturday evening under the orders of President Donald Trump. The Houthis said the attacks targeted Sana'a and then expanded to include other governorates. The U.S. strikes resumed at dawn today, killing 24 people and wounding 23. The strikes were partly carried out by fighter jets from the aircraft carrier, the USS Harry S. Truman, with targets including radar, air defense, missile systems, and drones. Although U.S. officials said the strikes targeted military sites, the Houthi group confirmed that the bombing targeted civilian sites, killing and wounding mostly women and children. These attacks follow the Houthi announcement that they would resume targeting Israeli ships in the region's waterways in response to the Israeli renewed blockade of food and medical aid to the Gaza Strip, and after the Trump administration redesignated the Houthis as a terrorist group. The Houthi Political Bureau condemned the U.S. bombing, stating that the U.S.-British aggression would not go unanswered and that Houthi resistance forces were fully prepared to confront escalation with escalation. The Bureau said in a statement that these raids would not deter the Yemeni people from continuing to support Palestine by backing the people of Gaza and their rights to resist the Israeli occupation and ongoing genocide against the oppressed Palestinians. The statement also said that the blatant aggression against Yemen confirms that America is fighting on behalf of the Zionist regime, which is condemned globally. President Trump said yesterday that he had ordered the military to launch a decisive and forceful military operation against what he described as Houthi terrorists in Yemen. Trump also warned Iran against continuing its support for the Yemeni group, saying that if Iran threatens the United States, quote, America will hold you fully accountable and we will not be kind about it. And that's a wrap of the news from around the world for Sunday, March 16th, 2025. I'm Lee Rowe.
I'm Neil Adams.
I'm Andrew Karn.
And I'm Gail Halstead.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Agence France-Presse, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, Anadolu, the Associated Press, the BBC, Deutsche Welle, France 24, The Guardian, Middle East Eye, Middle East Monitor, People's Dispatch, Reuters, Science Advisor, and Sana.
Welcome to the Worldview feature for this March the 16th, 2025. I'm Gil Halstead. I'm your host. And I'm joined in the studio today by my co-host, Amitabh Pal, who is the communications director for the Freedom From Religion Foundation here in Madison, and our special guest today, Carlos Davalos. He is a Mexican national and is now on the staff this year at WORT, thanks to support of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for the Humanities and the Graduate School of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so he has been a journalist for many years in Mexico. He is here, as we said, at the Graduate School now, and it turns out that he's the perfect choice to provide us with an introduction to the issues and politics involved in Mexico's judicial overhaul and all of the things that we've been hearing about, especially this week, response from Mexico to the Trump policies on tariffs and the border. And so, Carlos, thank you very much. Thank you, Amit, for joining us.
Thank you, Gil. Always a pleasure.
And Carlos, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Carlos Davalos is a journalist from Mexico City, as Gil said, and is the 2024-25 Mellon Public Humanities Fellow working here at WORT as WORT's 89.9 FM's Spanish Language Programming Fellow. And Carlos is extremely well-credentialed. He has a master's degree from UT Austin and a graduate school journalism degree, a master's from none other than UC Berkeley, has reported for Mexico City news outlets and has had various roles in the Mexican media, journalism and music sectors, including at a morning news show, music supervision position, and a coordinator and management position at Sony Music Mexico, has blogged. So it is such a pleasure and privilege for us to have Carlos Davalos.
Thank you. Thanks
so much. Explain Mexico to us.
Thanks so much for that introduction.
Yeah. So Carlos, let's start with what's on everybody's minds, and that is President Trump's back and forth with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum on issues ranging from tariffs to, as Gil mentioned, the border to the Gulf of Mexico. So how do you think President Sheinbaum has handled all this pressure from President Trump?
I think that both inside of Mexico and outside of Mexico, the response that President Sheinbaum has had has been terrifically positive. Mexican outlets have recognized how she has handled, even before she came into office, she started having very clear positions, very clear premises to approach a really complex relationship, which is the Mexico-U.S. relationship. Let's not forget that the diplomatic relationship between Mexico and the U.S. pretty much started around the 1840s, a really long time ago, with President Folk, and at that time I can't remember Mexico's president, but it is the those are the years when half of Mexican territory was I'm going to use the word taken by the United States. We're talking about Texas. We're talking about Arizona. We're talking about California. So the diplomatic relationship, as we know it right now, started back then. You know, we have a lot of episodes in both countries. International episodes, the Mexican Revolution, the World War II, you know, in the 20th century. So Mexico and the United States have had a really, really close relationship, at some point turbulent, at some point very, very cooperative. And I think it's important to take all that into account when thinking about this very, very last episode, which is the Trump Sheinbaum relationship in terms of both presidencies. I'm thinking right now of Canada, which also has been a terrific or a very close ally of the United States, and how different both countries have handled the Trump presidency. I remember Prime Minister Justin Trudeau going to Mar-a-Lago even before Trump went to Washington, D.C. to become the president. Claudia Sheinbaum never ever did that. She never set foot in Florida. So, you know, it's been I think, a clear, distant position. She now, she constantly talks about having a cold head, being called, you know, like in Spanish, cabeza fría. And it's almost a motto now, a slogan that a lot of people repeat in terms of approaching the relationship. And it's been a model for a lot of other countries in this continent and in Europe primarily to approach that the current American presidency.
Yeah, and we saw this week this huge outpouring in Mexico City that got really heavy reporting in terms of what there were more, almost 400,000 people came out to hear Sheinbaum speak. And I think that the articles that I read about that, Carlos, indicated that the history that you were recording here is something that she pointed out in her own comments and reminding Mexican citizens, you know, where they had come from to where they are today in terms of setting the context for what's happening between the two countries right now. And so Mexico and Latin America as a whole is already grappling with the second presidency of Trump. And you just referred to the second question that we have here about lessons to offer to the leaders of other countries. I mean, you were pointing out that, right, how Justin Trudeau and how now we've got a new prime minister in Canada.
Yes. I'm going to take the risk here right now to say that if it wasn't for President Sheinbaum negotiating with Trump, the outcome between Canada and the United States would have been very, very different. I think she set the pace. She set the example of how to talk to a president like this. And not only that, she, I think, left the energy pretty big quotation marks, easy to handle energy for that same day. Let's not forget that in both episodes, the same day, the current administration in the United States backed off in terms of the tariffs. So in the morning, the first phone call that Trump had with any of both countries was with Mexico in the morning at 8 a.m. I remember this perfectly because I was following Mexican news shows. And then a few hours later, around 4 p.m., Trump also had a phone call with the Canadian cabinet. So it was Sheinbaum who set the tone, she was the one that pretty much set the example again of how to approach a conversation like that and how to get results, which I think it's the important part of the whole equation of the whole of these conversations that both countries had.
So broadening our conversation, Carlos, President Claudia Sheinbaum assumed the presidency in October. So it's been just some months. How would you assess her presidency more broadly?
I have to recognize the bias that I have for her. I really like mm-hmm. how she has done things. I am originally from Mexico City, and she was the mayor of Mexico yeah. City for right before, not right before, but a couple of years before becoming the president. I think she did a really great job. There's been ups and downs, like in every administration, I think. But she has done a terrific job in terms of dealing with international issues, having making Mexico have a strong international presence. And at the same time, she's also dealing with a lot of internal issues that Mexico is dealing with right now. She is stepping into a really, really big politician's shoes, which is Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO, which is a huge political figure in Mexican politics and Mexican history, loved by a lot, hated by many others. But I think, you know, in terms of filling his shoes, Claudia Sheinbaum has done a terrific job in terms of, again, initiating an international dialogue that was stopped by the previous president, but also, for example, opening Mexico to a lot of international investment, which is also something that the previous president, for 6 years, let's not forget that Mexico has 6 years, 6 year terms, presidency terms, and there's no re-election. And in those 6 years that AMLO had, the international investments in Mexico didn't stop, but they were significantly less. So, you know, she's been able to open that again. And I think she has had a really clear stand in terms of internal security, which is also a big thing in Mexican internal affairs. You know, she's dealing with all the security issues in a much, much stronger way than, again, AMLO.
Let's look at the two big issues that I think many of us here and following the media think of in terms of U.S.-Mexican relations, and that's the tariffs and immigration. And immigration related to at least the way the Trump administration seems to be highlighting it more and more these days, as with Canada as well, is to talk about drugs. He's talking a lot about drugs and the cartels, and in particular fentanyl pouring in, according to Trump, from both borders. And so I'm actually most interested in starting with that because during this, was it just this past week, there was this increased effort on the part of Mexico, led by Sheinbaum, to do some cracking down on cartels, arresting more people, and actually sending some cartel criminals back to the U.S. for trial. If you could just comment on that a little bit, because that's sort of what's been in the
headline. Yeah, I have two immediate comments that I can share, and I'm going to repeat her words. She has a daily press conference where she shares the how things are going in her administration. She first quoted the DEA, American DEA, American agency, saying that there are 32 states in the United States that have registered cartel activity. So she was saying, well, we can definitely work in this issue, but what about what you Americans can do on the other side of the border? And then another issue that she mentioned in one of these conferences a couple of weeks ago was that another agency, I think, I can't remember the acronym right now, it will come to me probably in the next few minutes, but there is an American report confirming that 70% of the guns that are used in cartels, you know, are coming from the United States. 70% that are being trafficked from the U.S. to Mexico by American citizens. So she is doing a lot of things inside the Mexican territory, but at the same time, she's also pointing out all the actions that the current American government could do, on one side, and then on the other side, talking about the 29 people that she sent. I think, you know, that was a huge thing. That was one of the people that that one of the main cartel leaders that she sent has been chased, you know, that's the first word that comes to me, by American agencies since the 80s. He was responsible for the death of a DEA agent called Kiki Camarena. And he stayed in Mexican territory, and President Sheinbaum was the first one, or the only one, I should say, that actually sent him to the United States to be judged and trialed by American courts. So those are two very big things that she is doing that we have not seen. Let's forget about the previous president. Any president before has never done something so big. So, you know, there are actions that we can actually see and verify from the Mexican government that has that have been clearly executed by President Sheinbaum that I think say a lot about what the intentions are and about what the, you know, the purpose of her administration is in terms of security. You know, she's also, you know, we can talk about all the Guardia Nacional troops that she's sending to the border. You know, I think it's around 10,000 elements, you know, boots on the ground. So there are, and also let's not forget that the southern Mexican border, which is, you know, a huge issue, a huge, it's a huge part of the entire security equation, has also been secured by President Sheinbaum. So there are a lot of things that I think mainstream media, at least, have missed. I celebrate that here at WORT we're talking about these issues because all the other big platforms are not reporting on any of the things that I just mentioned.
So, Carlos, as anybody who follows Mexico knows, that AMLO, as you referred to him, and President Sheinbaum, belonged to a relatively new party called Morena, which thinks of itself as progressive. And you've expressed your enthusiasm for President Sheinbaum. Would you agree that it generally, you know, they've put into place progressive policies? And if so, you know, what sorts?
You know, that's a, it's a, there are a lot of contradictions, I should say.
Sure.
You know, Morena, it's a byproduct, you know, of a really, really big historical, you know, important Mexican political party, which is PRI, P-R-I, that was in power for 71 years,
wow,
you know,
yeah,
from the end of the Mexican Revolution around the early 1920s to the year 2000. When
there was a great comment, if I may interrupt, by Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa, who called Mexico under PRI the perfect dictatorship.
Yes. That's a very famous comment. And I think in a way it makes sense, you know, because it was not a person, it was a group of people.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, that group of people by the end of those 71 years were definitely abusing the power dynamic. And so PRI went out of power or lost the Mexican presidency to Vicente Fox in the year 2000. And that started to, you know, change things and crack the spheres of power in the Mexican political landscape. And Morena, which is a direct effort of, again, AMLO as a political figure. Let's not forget, too, that AMLO was also Mexico City's mayor around 20, 25 years ago, maybe, in the early 2000s. And that's when he started, well, before that, obviously, he left PRI in the late 80s, if I'm remembering correctly. And then he was part of another really important leftist party called PRD, PRD. And then he was a militant of that party for 15 years. And then in the year, I checked this, in the year 2014, that's when he formed Morena, which is, you know, it's a new party. It's a party that has a lot of power now. People are criticizing Morena a lot because they are replicating a lot of the PRI, the PRI actions that we saw as, big quotation marks, a perfect dictatorship for many years. However, I should say that there's a lot of really, really young people in the you know, outside President Sheinbaum or AMLO that are in really, central positions of power. Things like abortion have been at the center of their priorities. And at the same time, there's also a lot of contradictions. You know, I'm thinking, for example, right now, one of the Morena governors in a Mexican state. Mexico has 32 states. One of them is called Guerrero, which is in the southern west coast. That state has a family of politicians that have done a really, really, I want to say, nasty job of representing those values. So, you know, there are a lot of contradictions between what they stand for and some of the elements or some of the people that they have chosen to represent the party. I think Sheinbaum, again, I recognize my bias, but I think she's doing a great job in terms of social welfare, in terms of programs for people that are small entrepreneurs, in terms of, again, I think it was a really important aspect of putting Mexico in the international map again. And she's doing a great job in that sense. But also attending the issues that Mexico is facing inside its own borders, territory.
Right. And one of the things that I saw in looking at the coverage over this past week connected to this big gathering of 350,000 people in the square to listen to her was, and that this coincided to a certain extent with International Women's Day, and talking about issues that, and you mentioned abortion, that Sheinbaum is focusing on. She has called this the year of the indigenous woman in Mexico. This has been one of the lead things that she's talked about. And I guess that's interesting to me. I'm just sort of chiming back to you that she's, in terms of the internal policies that she's trying to address, this one in particular, she is...
Yes. So that big gathering that you're referring to happened exactly a week ago, last Sunday, and it was originally a really big public town hall to present or to share or to communicate the political measures that she was going to take against the tariffs. But before that gathering, she negotiated with Trump in a way that tariffs went away, and the gathering became sort of like a national, party, I guess, or a national congregation of Mexican citizens. And the day before, Saturday, was precisely International Women's Day, March 8th. So there was a lot of things that coincided that same weekend, and President Sheinbaum was in front of hundreds of thousands of Mexicans celebrating that, in a way that small battle with the American presidency was using a lot of quotation marks here, but was won, you know, and at the same time celebrating that she is she's the first Mexican woman president, you know, setting an example for at least North America. You know, and, let's remember that Mexico is part of North America, and considering that all three countries' political history, she's the first woman that it's a president.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So. As Gil knows, I'm a big movie buff, Carlos, and something that caught my attention was Emilia Perez, which at the recent Oscars had 13 nominations, got two Oscars, renowned French director, directed the movie, but was interestingly not very well liked in Mexico, where the movie is set. Can you explain to us why?
Yeah, I mean, I have to, first of all, disclose that I have not seen the movie yet. I should.
I have.
So. Yeah, okay.
I have not. And I feel like I have to. but I followed the reviews inside and outside Mexico. Sure. And there was a huge difference in between what reviewers in the United States or in Europe were saying about the movie versus the reviews that I saw from film critics and inside Mexico. And I think, you know, for Mexicans, the issue is it's a really central issue in terms of social events. Mexico, there's a Mexican city, Mexican border city, Ciudad Juárez, that by the late 90s and early 2000s had a really huge crisis with women disappearing.
Sure.
Let's not forget that Mexico, I'm not sure if Mexican legislation invented the term femicide. I think, you know, this is something that we would have to double check. But at least the Mexican laws have used it a lot to define and to talk about the disappearance of women for the simple fact of being women. You know, so it's a very sensitive issue in Mexico. Sure. So a lot of reviewers, a lot of artists, a lot of actors, a lot of directors, Mexican directors, and a lot of people in Mexican society were not happy with how the topic was treated and handled in Emilia Pérez, the movie, you know. Yeah. And there were people saying that also, you know, in terms of the language, the Spanish was really, really broken, you know. People were saying that they were using just Google Translation for
interesting. I've not heard that.
I don't know about this. We will have to double check this. But, you know,
that's the way it sounded to those people anyway, that it was not.
The director, even though he is a really well-known and respected director, he is not Mexican, so he's not close to the issues. The cast, you know, the people that were acting in the movie were not necessarily close to the issues either. So, you know, I have another type of bias there. And again, I haven't seen the movie, so I would have a much more built or constructed opinion.
Yeah,
I think
you should see it just to see it, because, and I would just, we're about to wrap up the interview right now, but. To me, the interesting aspect of it was that, I mean, it's a musical, okay? And that's what it won for, being a musical. But the actual, the way that it portrays the drug war and sort of gives you a cartel leader who then turns around and becomes this...
Transitions,
not only sexually, but comes back and helps out people that, you know, her own cartel were... It's kind of a fantasy, it seems to me. I don't know that we've really seen anything like cartel leaders doing what the character in this movie does.
If I remember correctly, I think it's based on some kind of reality episode of Mexican cartels. Again, I'm not sure. This is something that I would have to also double check. But yeah, I would. I know that it's a musical too. I think that's an important part about the movie. Yeah, but I will definitely see it. And
with that, we really have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for coming, Carlos. And I think we've all learned a lot. And we maybe should talk about making this a more regular thing as long as you're around. Because
it would be my pleasure. Absolutely.
Excellent.
I hoped I could. I was able to provide information that maybe, you know, it's not regularly heard on mainstream media.
Very much so.
I appreciate the opportunity and thanks. Yeah, we should try to do that.
So, thank you. And that is Worldview for this week. Thank you to Carlos for coming into the studio to talk with us. And thank you to the Worldview Collective members, Neil Adams, Sabia Tie, Chuck Benish, Andrew Karn, Gil Halstead, and Amitabh Pal for bringing international news to WORT listeners. And thanks also to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shally Pittman. And we especially thank you for listening. Please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org, or on the app. And you can still donate until midnight. And now, stay tuned for Salamat.
F-
Folklore Village presents A Lash Ensemble on Friday, March 28th at 7 p.m. A Lash Ensemble comes to us from the Republic of Tuva, which sits at the southern edge of Siberia, with Mongolia to the south. Over the centuries, Tuva has been part of Chinese and Mongolian empires and shares many cultural ties with Mongolia. All members of A Lash were trained in traditional Tuvan music since childhood, first learning from their families and later becoming students of master throat singers. Musicians are inspired by the music of extended family generations of Tuva and Central Asia. At the same time, they are influenced by such Western artists as Sun Ra and Jimi Hendrix. More information is available at folklorevillage.org. Folklore Village presents the Tuvan throat singing of A Lash Ensemble on Friday, March 28th at 7 p.m. at Folklore Village, 3210 County Road BB, just outside of Dodgeville. Live music lives.